This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Former Hamilton County Auditor Bridget Kelly died Tuesday, less than a week after resigning her post as auditor. She was 40. Today, we're going to talk about what she accomplished as a public servant. We'll also discuss the new state felony charges against former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder and a new report that found only a third of Cincinnati neighborhoods added housing units between 2010 and 2020. It's our weekly news review, and we have all that and more to talk about. Joining me now to get us started are WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for being here today, Howard.
Thank you, Lucy.
And Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Howard, Bridget Kelly died Tuesday, as I mentioned, less than a week after she resigned as Hamilton County Auditor. Yeah. You knew her. Tell us about Bridget Kelly. What kind of person was she?
Well, Lucy, as you know, I mean, I've been doing this for a very long time, and I've met a whole lot of people in politics. There are good people, there are not so good people. There are people who make an impression, there are people who don't make an impression. And Bridget stands out because of the kind of person she was. She was, number one, kind. She was friendly. She made friends easily. She didn't seem to have any bitterness in her body as a politician. She was more than willing to work with people of the other party. And that's why I think, you know, when she passed away, that I saw tributes to her from all across the political spectrum, Democrats, Republicans, union people, hardcore conservatives, and they all liked her. And they all believed that she had a huge impact on public policy, not only, you know, in the auditor's office, obviously, in recent months, but as a state legislator, as a Norwood City Council person, and as a union official, as a person who worked for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union for a long time.
Yeah. And she was only 40, which is just so heartbreaking. Yeah. Yeah. She had, as you mentioned, she'd served in public office at lots of different levels and really covered a lot of ground at such a young age, hadn't she?
Yeah, she did. You know, for 40 years, that is a whole lot of accomplishment in politics and government and public policy. And it's a lasting mark. And I think, you know, there's another generation of political people coming up. And I've seen this in the last few days, too, particularly on social media, who were inspired by her. And they'll continue to be inspired by her, even if she's not there, you know, to be the leading voice anymore.
Yeah. You mentioned her work as a union activist. Tell us a little bit more about what she did in that role.
Well, she was basically an organizer for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, the UFCW, which employs basically grocery store employees and others, you know, in the food industry. And she worked for Steve Coulter, who was the executive secretary treasurer of USCW Local 75 here for many years. And they ended up getting married. They were husband and wife. And she was extremely dedicated to the union movement. And that kind of comes from her Kelly background. You know, the Kellys have always been involved in unions in Norwood. And it's, you know, it was just part of her DNA.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned she did serve in the Ohio House of Representatives. What mm-hmm. was she known for there? Is there any particular legislation that she's particularly known for?
Well, she did a lot of things, particularly with, you know, in regard to children's safety and those kind of, you know, issues and education. Excuse me. And she was known particularly for reaching across the aisle to Republicans in the legislature and working on special projects. Like one time she teamed up with Tom Brinkman, who's one of the most conservative far-right state representatives that this area has had for a long time, and they teamed up to get funding for a major development project out in Madisonville. And people, looked and said, "Wow, if these two can get along together and agree on something, then it must be okay." And it sailed through the legislature. So, she did not hesitate to find her allies outside of her comfort zone of Democratic politics. And if you and you know that that is really unusual these days. There's so much anger and bitterness between political parties these days. But Bridget would she's a strong Democrat, no doubt about it, but she was willing to work across the aisle.
You know, we mentioned that she had been Hamilton County Auditor, resigned that position less than a week before she died. This has been such a challenging time for the Hamilton County Auditor's Office. And really, as we've come to learn, the whole time she held that office, she was dealing with a cancer diagnosis, wasn't she?
Yes, absolutely. For the last 2 years. She went to work every day and she did the job. And as you say, it was a very difficult place to be because the reappraisals that have gone on in the last couple of years. But she was totally dedicated to getting it done. She w was recommended for that job by her predecessor, Dusty Rhodes, who had held that position for 30 years. And I talked to Dusty the morning after Bridget had passed away, and Dusty said there was no question about I knew that she would do that job and do it well, and that she would do it with integrity, and that she would treat her employees at the auditor's office the way they would want to be treated. And so she loved those people, and they loved her back.
Two-part question for you. What will you remember most about Bridget Kelly, and how do you think she would want to be remembered?
Well, I mean, I'll remember her kindness. Particularly, I experienced it myself a couple of times. I remember when my mother passed away, she called me. And one day up in Columbus, where I was being honored by University of Akron at the hotel across the street from the State House, and somehow she found out about it and came running across the street to the hotel to, congratulate me. But, she's remembered for those acts of kindness. And that's what everybody who knew her, talked to her, even had just, minimal dealings with her, walked away and said, "What a wonderful person that is. This is a very special person." And that doesn't happen very often with a politician.
Do you have any ideas how she would want to be remembered?
I think that's the way she wants to be remembered, is somebody who, number one, did her job, got it done, made people's lives better, and was kind and decent, and tried to help people. That's the way she wanted to be remembered, I'm sure. And she'll get her wish.
Quite a legacy. Well, Sarah, let's talk about another former state lawmaker who was in the news this week for very different reasons. Former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder was indicted on multiple state felony charges this past week. Tell us about the charges.
So, Attorney General Dave Yost says this is kind of the natural next step in the process of holding former Speaker Larry Householder accountable. Federal charges supersede state and local charges, which he is already serving a 20-year prison sentence for the federal charges that he was convicted of last year. But the big difference with these state charges, there are 10 of them that he was indicted on Monday, are if he's convicted on one of them, he could be barred from ever holding office again. And Yost said in prepared remarks that that's kind of the key, that Yost has heard from some lawmakers around the state house that they're concerned, you know, householders in the process of appealing his 20-year sentence, and they're concerned he could kind of come back and suddenly make a third run for office.
Yeah, he's kind of known as the comeback kid, right?
Yeah, that's what Yost referred to him as.
Yeah. And I want to remind our listeners, these federal charges were for crimes related to House Bill 6, the failed nuclear energy bailout that involved First Energy. Is that why Attorney General Dave Yost says it's so important to pursue these state charges, to that if he is convicted, he wouldn't be able to run again?
Yeah, that's the reasoning that's been given. And it's also got to do with, you know, the broader corruption scheme that's gone on, that he's also being accused of misusing campaign funds to pay for his defense. So there's kind of a lot going on there.
Yeah, a lot of charges, a lot of detail in the story that you and your colleagues put together. You noted that Larry Householder is appealing his conviction on the federal charges. Has there been any response from him or his lawyers regarding these new charges? Is it too soon for that?
I don't know that there's been a response yet. It may be a bit soon because they're in the process of appealing the 20 years in prison. You know, there is his appeal that was filed late in February was, I think, over 100 pages. So, you know, they've been building that argument, and now they've got these new state charges to mm-hmm. potentially answer to, and that's going to be an entire new process.
Yeah. Lot to do there. Well, now tell us about this lawsuit that the ACLU of Ohio filed against the state this week.
This had been something we were waiting for as soon as, so the lawsuit is over House Bill 68, which I'm sure folks will remember back in December passed, and there was a lot of back and forth. It's both a ban on what's called gender-affirming care for minors. Gender-affirming care is generally to treat the condition of gender dysphoria. And it's also a ban on transgender minors playing in sports that align with their gender identity. So kind of two parts there, and that plays into the lawsuit. So the bill passed the legislature in December, and then Governor DeWine at the end of the month, that month, vetoed the bill. Lawmakers came back in January and overrode that veto. So kind of the end point there was back in January, House Bill 68 became law because lawmakers were able to override Governor DeWine's veto. And from there, the ACLU of Ohio said, we're going to file litigation over this law. You can expect it to come soon. So House Bill 68 is set to go into effect at the end of April, so next month, and the ACLU has officially filed their lawsuit in the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas against HB 68.
Mm-hmm. And who are the plaintiffs that this lawsuit is being filed on behalf of?
So there are two Ohio families, both under pseudonyms, under Jane Doe pseudonyms. It's two 12-year-old trans girls. One of them is from the Cincinnati area and the other one's from the Columbus area, and their families. And the girls are both transgender, and it's filed. Dave Yost is named as the defendant in the case because he has to defend the law on the behalf of the state.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, the ACLU's been threatening to file suit over this law for a while now. How does the organization characterize this ban especially?
So they're filing the lawsuit on a couple of different charges. And going back to one of the things that they argue is they say this bill is unconstitutional because it breaks the single subject rule. So in Ohio, bills technically have to focus on one subject. That is very, very loosely followed. Anyone who follows the state house knows that when Ohio legalized sports gambling, however long ago, those provisions were stuffed into a veteran ID bill. So the single subject rule is not often followed at the state house, or it's followed very loosely, but the ACLU of Ohio is partly suing over that because they say that the gender-affirming care ban and the sports ban are two entirely different things. They're also suing because they say it's discriminatory against these girls, that they won't be able to access medically necessary health care if this ban goes into effect.
I know Representative Gary Click was a key supporter of House Bill 68. What did he say about this lawsuit?
Yeah, so I was talking to him. It was pretty prescient. I was talking to him like 30 minutes before the lawsuit was filed about something unrelated, and I asked him about it. And he said, you know, I think they're going to give it their best shot, but I don't think they stand much of a chance. He said he has a lot of faith in the Attorney General and Dave Yost to defend the law. And it's kind of a mixed bag when you look outside of Ohio, because other states have passed similar gender-affirming care bans. Ohio is not the first state to do so. Some states, I mean, often these laws, like it will in Ohio, have gone to the courts. Some courts have upheld the laws and others haven't. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
And what's next with this case? Will the law automatically be paused and not go into effect, or is that something the court needs to decide?
So that's something we're waiting to see. The law goes into effect in about a month. The plaintiffs, the ACLU of Ohio, and these families have asked for a preliminary injunction to put the law on pause until the case proceeds. And obviously, the legal system moves slow, so that would be for some time. It remains to be seen if they're trying to get like a temporary restraining order to come before that preliminary injunction. The goal of the ACLU is to put this law on pause before it takes effect. I mean, they want to see it put on pause prior to taking it effect, and they obviously don't want it to take effect at all. But I think the ACLU's goal is to get that preliminary injunction. So I just checked the Franklin County Court website a couple of minutes ago, and I haven't seen an initial hearing scheduled yet, but we'll be following it.
Okay. Well, we will count on your reporting to keep us up to date. I've been talking with WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, we'll discuss a new report that looks at how many housing units Cincinnati neighborhoods gained or lost between 2010 and 2020. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A new report released this week found only a third of Cincinnati's neighborhoods added housing units between 2010 and 2020. Joining me now to discuss that report and some other news from the past week is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Hi, Lucy.
This report, the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber is the organization that issued this report on housing that you wrote about this week. What were the big findings?
Yeah, so the biggest thing to remember before we get into the details is when we talk about adding housing, this report is looking at the net growth. So that means, you know, there may have been construction on a lot more units than what we're talking about today, but because the city is also losing housing units, that means that the net growth is well, for the whole city, it's actually in the negative. The city lost over 2,000 housing units from 2010 to 2020. And like I said, that's not because the city didn't build any housing units. It's just the city's lost more housing units than have been added in that decade. And then, you know, as you said in kind of the intro, the other big finding is that most Cincinnati neighborhoods, in fact, two thirds of Cincinnati neighborhoods lost more housing than they gained. And so even though the city is growing, gained about 12,000 residents from 2010 to 2020, there's still not enough housing. And the city's actually kind of gone in the opposite direction on that.
Hmm. So Cincinnati gained more than 12,000 residents in that decade from 2010 to 2020, but had a net loss of more than 2,000 housing units. Why? What's going on with that?
Well, there's a couple reasons why a city might lose housing. So one is kind of maybe the obvious one, which is there's a lot of old housing in the city, old buildings, and if they're not maintained properly, then they just become unlivable. And so, you know, they might be vacant for a little bit, aren't maintained properly, and so need to be demolished, or might be sitting there but not able to be occupied. So they're not, you know, permitted to have a residence there. So that's a big way that the city loses housing. Another might be, for example, let's say there's a home in a neighborhood that has been converted to a triplex or a duplex. So there's two housing units on that site. But then somebody buys it and converts it back to a single family home. So that means one of those housing units has been lost. So that's another way that the city can lose housing.
Which neighborhood saw the largest decrease in housing units?
So there's two kind of ways to look at this. There's the largest absolute number of units, and that would be Avondale. Avondale lost over 1,000 units. It's 1,088 units. That's the largest housing unit decrease by absolute change. But think about it too. Obviously, neighborhoods are all different sizes, and so there another way to look at it is the percentage of a neighborhood's housing that was lost in that time frame. And if you look at that, Sedansville is actually the number one on that list, and they lost basically 27% of housing units in that neighborhood.
Wow. For the neighborhoods that added housing units, some didn't add very many, right? I mean, even the ones that gained didn't necessarily gain a whole lot. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, number one on the list is downtown, and it's a sizable number. It's 1,097 new units, but it's a pretty big drop after that number one on the list. So second to, and this is not percentage again, this is just the absolute number. But second on that list is Oakley with 692, and then another big drop from there. By the time you get to the number 10 of the top 10 neighborhoods that added housing units, it's only 35 units. And after that, you see a couple in the 20s, 15, that range, that kind of thing.
And I know you talked to the guy at the chamber who really was the number cruncher or the lead number cruncher who put this together. How did he explain that, especially those neighborhoods that had growth, but just a little bit of growth?
Well, the other way to look at this and why there might not be much growth is the reason that the city is kind of looking at some zoning changes, and that's it's becoming prohibitively expensive to add housing or to build anything, really. So, if there, for example, it would be feasible to build a, 200 unit apartment building, but the zoning only allows a 100 unit apartment building, and you just can't make the financing work because of that, then that doesn't get built. And so then you get no housing. That's obviously an oversimplification of a very complicated process, but that's one thing that, Brandon Rudd, who did the study at the chamber, explained. That's one way that these regulatory barriers can prevent growth because it makes it, like I said, just prohibitively expensive and time consuming, and obviously time adds money as well to build these housing developments.
Well, and speaking of expensive, what did this study find in terms of housing growth and how that relates to home values?
Yeah, so the other thing that this study looks at is, you've got, say, the 10 larger or the 10 neighborhoods that added the most housing versus the 10 neighborhoods that lost the most housing, and what happened to home values in those areas. And so the correlation is basically that in areas that added housing, there was a more moderate increase to home value. Now, it doesn't mean that home values didn't go up at all in those neighborhoods. Significantly, we're looking at a 13-year period here, so 2010 to 2023. Obviously, home values kind of rose quite a bit in that time. But it was a much more moderate or modest increase in the neighborhoods that had added housing. And it's a pretty significant difference. I feel like I say this all the time, scrolling to the right page on the screen that I'm looking at. But so, for example, so Evanston, it was the neighborhood that had the largest home value increase by percent change, 651% increase in home values between 2010 and 2023. But looking at some of the value increases in neighborhoods that added housing, you're getting more at like 36% downtown, 13%. Oh, I'm sorry. Please scratch that. That was looking at the wrong page. That's the increase in housing units, but it is a much more moderate increase in home value for those neighborhoods.
Okay. Does this report include an analysis of rent? Cincinnati has a whole lot of residents who are renters.
It does not. And there is an explanation in the report for that. And I did ask Brandon about that. And he said, yeah, it would be much more accurate and informative to look at rent prices. Unfortunately, when you're looking at kind of a really granular level like this, you're looking at individual neighborhoods, really individual census tracts. There just either isn't data available for all those neighborhoods, or the data that is available just isn't very reliable. So the best way, you know, that this report could look at housing costs was to look at home value. Now, obviously, some of those renters are going to be in single family homes that might be included in this report, but it does not look at the cost of housing for, you know, apartments or other multifamily housing.
Okay. Well, let's go beyond housing and talk about how Cincinnati residents are feeling about the city as a whole. A consulting firm just released the results of a new survey of city residents. What are people most concerned about, at least based on that survey?
Well, not surprisingly, the biggest concern for folks is public safety. This is the second time that this consulting firm has done this survey, this report. And the last year they did sort of a supplemental in between the two main surveys. And public safety has been a concern throughout all of those. So it's you know, something that is consistent with prior reports as well. So there's sort of two ways to look at this. One is what do people consider to be the most important? And so they're looking at public safety and streets. So the condition of streets and sidewalks, those are kind of the top two. But then also, what are the respondents least satisfied with? And not surprisingly, those are kind of the top two as well. So residents consider it the most important, but they're also the least satisfied with the city's kind of handling of those issues.
So streets and sidewalks and public safety. Did the consultants who did the survey, or even city officials who heard the results, did they feel like those concerns made sense based on, you know, the city's data, what's going on in the city right now?
Yeah, I think public safety is the one that obviously is a little bit the most concerning to hear about. And something that the folks who did the survey cautioned is that one other factor they look at is or another factor they look at is where people get their information about what's going on in the city and city government. The number one way that people get their information, according to these respondents, is through TV news. And the survey, or sorry, the consulting firm, ETC Institute, had some strong words about the way that TV news, and you know, from their perspective and based on the research they've done in cities throughout the country, TV news tends to overestimate how much violence is happening in a city. You know, they tend to focus on like shootings and stories like that might kind of change the perception of a resident who's looking at that. So, you know, if you look at the actual numbers, and I did for this story, you can see that the violent crime in Cincinnati is down about 10% compared to the previous 3-year average. Property crime is about the same. So there hasn't been an increase, or, you know, there has actually been a decrease in violent crime. So it doesn't really match up with what the perceptions show. And the survey consultants were basically saying it's not that surprising. They tend to see that in other cities as well when folks tend to get their news from TV news.
What were the most highly rated city services?
This also was consistent with some of the previous ones, and it's ones that folks might not be that surprised about, but fire and EMS services is top of the list. You also see parks and recreation centers are highly valued and are pretty happy with those services. You also see like some of these more vague responses that are asked about, you know, what is your perception of the overall image of the city, overall quality of life in the city, that kind of thing. Those were ranked pretty highly. There's some folks obviously dissatisfied, but primarily pretty happy with that. And also looking at trash and recycling, that was pretty high in there. City water utilities, health department services, that saw a little bit of a decrease compared to the last survey, but still ranked pretty high.
What does the city do with this information?
Well, I think one of the reasons that this was, for example, presented to council in the Budget and Finance Committee is because council is considering the next budget right now. And so this is one way that council members can look at what do city residents value? What do they want the city to focus on? So, for example, a couple of the priorities, we obviously talked about public safety. We talked about streets and sidewalks. One of the other ones was city communication. People are kind of dissatisfied with the effectiveness of city communication with the public, although I will note that did improve over the survey 2 years ago. But that's an area where council might look at and say, okay, we are seeing these priorities in this survey, so we know that in our budget needs to reflect those priorities. Obviously, it's not the only way that council can receive feedback on the budget. You know, there's public hearings and things like that, but this is one way. And I don't know if I said this at the beginning, but it is a statistically significant, it's a trustworthy survey. It's not, you know, hey, take this online poll through social media kind of thing that we see sometimes, and those can have their place. But this was, you know, conducted in a way that ensured that the sample size was reflective of the city's population. So that's including geography, race, gender, socioeconomic status. So it is a trustworthy survey to look at what the priorities are.
Well, let's talk about another decision that council members made this week. Council members voted on money to help renovate the historic King Records building in Evanston. What did council vote to do?
So this is a little bit of a complicated one because actually council, a previous council before this council was in office, approved $1 million to go towards the King Records preservation. It's a building in Evanston that has a lot of historical significance. It's currently vacant right now, but the city actually does own it. So there is kind of separately a King Records Legacy Foundation that is working to raise the money that is needed to go towards the renovation of this building. It actually started kind of in City Hall, but it is private folks, you know, not city employees that are focused on that. What this council needed to do, though, was, you know, all of that money is currently sitting in a capital account, which means it can be spent on construction costs. And the Legacy Foundation wanted to use some of that for pre-construction costs. So this is things like fundraising and other things. So this council had to kind of approve that sort of slight change. It's a little bit more complicated than that. It always is. But to put it very simply. So that was the change, is basically approving $205,000 to go toward these pre-construction or pre-development costs. And then the rest of the money is still earmarked and will go towards the actual construction.
Well, and the group working on this had asked for more money a few weeks ago, right? What happened with that?
Yeah, it was a little bit of an unusual move at City Council. So the original request from the foundation was $410,000 for pre-development costs. Now, here's where the kind of capital versus operating question comes into play here, because, you know, originally the original source of that $410,000 was the operating budget. So it could very easily have been used for pre-development costs, didn't have to be used for construction. But some council members were a bit concerned about that. They said, hey, that's a lot of money for pre-development. We don't usually approve that much for other similar projects. And we want to have a better plan for how you're going to spend this money. So they actually delayed the vote on that. And instead, the Legacy Foundation worked with the city officials, like the city staff who were helping them with it. And they came back on and said, OK, we're asking for less money, basically half of that. So $205,000 instead. They may come back in a year and say, hey, we would like a little bit more. We want to keep fundraising. But the foundation is hoping to raise $2 million over the next year with this kind of $205,000 as the seed money to help them do that. But the total renovation is going to cost a lot more than that, of course, probably between $15 and $20 million.
So this new request was kind of pared down after some feedback from council. How did council members respond to this new proposal?
Yeah, there were a couple of folks in particular who had some concerns. One was Councilmember Jeff Kramerding. He is kind of the most budget conscious council member right now, I would say. So that's something he brings up a lot. And he said he was really grateful for the extra time to both look at the project, but also to see the kind of more detailed plan that the foundation brought forward. And even at the beginning, he and other council members who had some questions, they always said from the beginning, we really support this project. We want King Records to be renovated. We know it's so important to not just Evanston, but the whole city. So they expressed some excitement that, you know, the project is still on track and that things can kind of get started now.
Great. Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, 65 years ago, big changes came to Covington. Now those changes are changing again. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Starting 65 years ago, parts of Covington were demolished to make way for the Brent Spence Bridge and an IRS facility built by the federal government. Now a lot of what was done back then is being redone or undone. Joining me now to talk about all this is WVXU General Assignment and Long-Form Reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for being with us. You've been reporting on Covington as part of a series we call Round the Corner. First, explain what Round the Corner is for people who aren't familiar.
Yeah, so Round the Corner is sort of our project where we take a look at a neighborhood or a community or an area in depth and really get in and kind of see what life's all about in that part of the world. And this one's a little different. We're actually kind of focused on the area around the Brent Spence Bridge Corridor project. A lot of that has been Covington. We've spent some time in the West End as well, just kind of seeing how that project is affecting those areas and the people that live in them.
And tell us how what's happening in and around Covington now compares to what happened about 65 years ago.
Yeah, so it kind of depends on how you do the math, like how long ago, you know, what we're talking about here. But starting in the late 1950s, Covington, as well as a lot of other cities around the country, was looking at money available from the federal government for what was called urban renewal. And in addition to that, the highway was coming through that was being planned right around the same time. And so that kind of put a lot of things on the horizon for Covington that would change in the next few years. And one of those being obviously the construction of the Brent Spence Bridge was started in 1961, but also the building of an IRS facility, a data processing center on the riverfront there in Covington. And that took a little longer to get going, but you know, as early as the very early 1960s, Covington had that on their radar. And by 1962, they had cleared a big portion of residential land in that part of Covington for the project.
And in your story on our website, WVXU.org, in your story, you refer to this as a full circle moment. Why do you call it that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think if you've seen the headlines, you know, about Covington lately, you know that there's another bridge coming, just as there was, you know, 60 to 65 years ago. And there's also a lot of activity around the IRS site that used to be there. It's been torn down now. So, you know, those two things that really, you know, kind of changed Covington a lot 60, 65 years ago, now we're changing again in really big ways. The corridor project is going to be a huge undertaking. And the IRS site, they're talking about making that into an entire new neighborhood, you know, where once there was a neighborhood before.
Wow. So this neighborhood was essentially leveled decades ago to make room for this humongous one-story IRS processing center. Now the IRS processing center has been leveled and a neighborhood's coming back. That's a lot going on. What does this say about the way people view cities now as compared to 60 or 65 years ago?
Yeah, you know, I talked to Covington Mayor Meyer about this, and he says, you know, it's part of a cycle. He said, you know, like people, cities have a life cycle. And, you know, he ties it into this renewed interest over the past decade or decade and a half or two decades of, you know, wanting to live in the city, wanting to be in an urban area. Whereas at the beginning of the 1960s, late 1950s, for a lot of reasons, some people were leaving the cities. They were getting on that freeway and heading out to the suburbs. And some of that was racial. Some of that was economic. Some of that was just, you know, cities felt cramped to people and they wanted more space. And we're kind of seeing a reversal of that nationally. We've seen it for a long time. And I think it's come to Covington a while ago, and you're seeing this new activity as a big sign of that.
Yeah. You talked with someone who used to live in one of the neighborhoods that got demolished for, you know, these projects. Tell us about him and what he said.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people will be familiar with the name Kenny Shields. He was NKU's basketball coach for a long time, kind of a legendary person in Covington. And it was just a joy to talk to him about the neighborhood he lived in. He lived on a small street called Elm Street, right by where the Radisson Hotel is now. And, you know, his recollection of that neighborhood, which has since been demolished, obviously, was that it was this really vibrant, tight-knit community. He remembers, like, he could list for, you know, several grocery stores within walking distance to him, you know, all these places to hang out as a kid, parks, places to play ball that were lost for the highway. And he kind of talks about it in a really whimsical way. And I think he accepts that change came and had to happen. But, you know, I think it was a little sad for him too to think back on his old stomping grounds that are now mostly parking lots and gas stations.
Sure. And there were Covington officials even back then who thought all this was a bad idea, right?
Yeah, you know, the city manager at the time, Joseph A. Dressman was his name. He, in the Cincinnati Inquirer, he said some things that really sound a lot like urbanists now when he was talking about these projects coming through. He's like, you know, like putting these expressways and these the parking lots and these gas stations into our downtowns, he said, and I quote, they're not the things people come downtown for. And he said, it's a mistake to try to create model new cities. They're beautiful things, but they have no souls, is like the direct quotation that he told the newspaper. Mm. And, you know, it's interesting how that echoes now, how like there are a lot of folks who would say very similar things on Twitter or, you know, in an urbanist kind of panel or something like that.
Yeah. Well, and you already talked about how Covington is, you know, basically rebuilding kind of a neighborhood on the IRS site that was where a neighborhood was cleared decades ago to make room for the IRS building. Are there any concerns that the bridge project, this companion bridge, will create more problems for any of Covington's neighborhoods?
Yeah, you know, you talk to people who live maybe around the bridge site, and some of them are like, hey, you know, we're already pretty divided. Now you're going to put another bridge here. I'm thinking specifically about West Covington, what some people call the Botany Hills neighborhood or other areas around there. And they're like, look, like, you know, we feel like we're kind of separated from the rest of the city already. And then there's going to be this other structure. What else are you going to do to kind of knit these communities back together? And, you know, I think the planning is ongoing for the sort of stretch of highway leading up to the bridge on both sides of the river. And so there might be some more conversation about what that looks like, or are there ways to kind of like stitch things back together with, you know, more pedestrian friendly infrastructure or green space, things like that. But yeah, people are concerned that it's going to make more of a division.
Yeah. Well, I've really enjoyed your reporting on this. I want to now, though, take us back across the river to Ohio. The Cincinnati-Hamilton County Community Action Agency is closing applications for its rent and property assistance program. When is that happening, and why is it happening?
So that is happening April 1st. Originally, it was supposed to be the end of April, and they've kind of like moved that deadline up because they have so many applications. They need time administratively to get through all of them to make sure that everybody who's applied gets a fair chance at the funds that are available. They have to close out this program, which is, I think, federal grant funded, by the end of June. So they need to kind of get moving on the applications they already have. And they have about 900 people in line right now. They've served about 8,000 people since this program started during the pandemic. And they're just trying to get through those last applications.
Wow. Thousands of people. And what kind of help has this program offered exactly?
So there's two different components. One is a little older than the other and dates back to the pandemic, and that is rental assistance. So you can get help if you can't make rent, if you're facing eviction. And then there's another portion of the program that is helping people with their property tax bills. We know that you know, property taxes have gone up quite a lot. It's been a lot for some people to handle. That kind of financial shock, this program helps you kind of deal with that on a sort of one-time basis.
And you mentioned thousands of people have been helped. How much money has been allocated through this program since it started during the pandemic?
It's about $35 million. And I think there are separate funds for the rental assistance and for the tax assistance. And I think with the tax assistance, especially, that funding is kind of running out. And so they're, you know, that's why kind of they're wrapping up a little bit.
Yeah. And you mentioned that a lot of this funding came from the federal government through grants. Can people still apply if they need help?
Yeah. The application process is still open until April 1st. And the Community Action Agency has said, we're gonna process every application we get up until that date. So there's still time to apply. And I would also like to note that Hamilton County also runs a rental assistance program in addition to a homeowner assistance program. And those are still open, and those are not going away right now.
Okay. Good to know. Well, while I've got you, I'm going to ask you about one more story you covered this past week. Cincinnati City Council approved some zoning changes for a housing development in Evanston This development's been kind of controversial. Tell us about the project.
Yeah, so this is a project to build two apartment buildings in Evanston that would be about 240 units. And that's a little controversial, mainly because of where it is, which is like on the side of this historic Hoffman school building. It's a 102-year-old, very ornate school building. They don't use it for schools anymore. It's the side of a church. And people are really reacting to that building being torn down. But there are also concerns about, hey, this this is too dense. You know, it's not as affordable as we would like. And, you know, there's not enough parking. Those kind of concerns have also popped up among people who live in Evanston, some people who live in Evanston.
Yeah. Has the developer altered any plans based on those concerns?
Yes. Originally, the buildings were going to be five stories, and there were going to be about 300 units of housing. And there was going to be some less parking, less green space. And they've tweaked things. So now each building is only four stories tall. They've reduced the number of units, and they've increased parking a bit.
Did any council members voice concerns or objections to this?
Yeah, so the vote on this came down 7-2. And Anna Albee, council member Anna Albee, and also Jeff Kramerding voted against it. And Albee said that she really was concerned about the affordability aspect of this. Originally, when this plan was floated, there was a different kind of mix of affordable and market rate units in it, and that's kind of been reduced. The developer and council members who support the program, the development, say it's because, you know, you got to make the numbers work. But, you know, she's saying basically like, these are going to be kind of expensive apartments. And, you know, that's not really what the community wants or needs. Jeff Kramerding voted against it more on the historic preservation line. Like, he doesn't want to see Hoffman School torn down and, you know, kind of wants to respect some residents' wishes that that building be saved somehow.
Yeah. But you said supporters on council said, hey, this is just what's got to happen to make the math work, essentially.
Yeah. Council member Reggie Harris especially has been pretty vocal about saying, like, listen, like, you know, the neighborhood asked to decrease the density of this development, you know, like less units. And at the same time, they want it to be more affordable. And, you know, generally, that's just really hard to do because the more units you have in a building, the sort of more money you're bringing in. And that, you know, makes the numbers work out. It's hard to reduce units and make a building more affordable unless you're getting subsidy, which this project is not seeking any kind of city or other subsidy, really.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with WVXU General Assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thanks so much for your time today, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.